Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, Robert Knott will be with us, as always, speaking of the arts. Right now, I would like to welcome Laura Gomez. She is a professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico. And she is the author of the book Manifest Destinies, Making of the Mexican-American Race. And she will be speaking today at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe on West San Francisco Street, right across the street from the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
It's great to have you here. Very interesting book. Especially for, I think, all around, but especially for us here in New Mexico. You write about the double colonization of what is now New Mexico, first by the Spanish, then by the Americans, both colonizations grounded in racism. What is it about race that is such an integral component of colonization, both specifically here and in general?
Well, I think in general terms, it was racism that allowed colonizers and allows colonizers in various contexts to feel that their activities are justified. So if you're going to take somebody's land or take somebody's women or take somebody's property, let's say grain that they've had stored, if you say that those people are racially deficient, are inferior to you, it makes it a lot easier to have a clear conscience about it. And the way that that fits in terms of, as you said, the Southwest is a really interesting region. We talk a lot in New Mexico about Spanish colonialism and that period of history. We talk far less of American colonization because I think that as Americans today, right, we tend to have this sense of, well, we didn't do anything wrong, and so it's not colonization. And one of the things that I'm trying to say in this book is, maybe whether it's wrong or right is not the issue, but there was a colonization of this region by the United States. You know, there was a war, and there were people who were displaced, and there was violence of various kinds of elements of colonization associated with that transition.
So how would you compare those two kinds of colonization, where the two specific colonizations, the Spanish colonization of this area with the Indians and then the American colonization of this area with the Spanish and Indian-Mexican mixture of people?
Well, one of the chief differences is that the way that the Spanish approached the Indians was to invite and even in certain ways encourage mixture across all racial groups. And we would also emphasize that we're not just talking about Indian and Spanish, but also African, because there were very substantial numbers of slaves taken to Mexico. And if you think about the connection of that to New Mexico, after the Pueblo Revolt, because of the Pueblo Revolt, all of the Spanish settlers leave. The people who repopulate New Mexico come from Mexico in that next century, and they are significantly Afro-Mestizo, Indo-Mestizo. In any event, the Spanish strategy was mixture, and then a ranking of hierarchy according to color, according to a sort of social status. And the Anglo-American strategy was one of separation. And so that created a different dynamic in terms of race, much more.
Yeah, when you think about the East Coast, where I'm from, I mean, there's the amount of mixing there of the early British settlers seems to be very minimal.
Right, although even some of that, I think, is understated. For instance, if you look at the original colonies and the mixture between whites and Indians, it was actually pretty significant. It's just that the definitions were such with those mixtures in that early period of U.S. history that those people were still white.
Exactly. And then we'll talk about this concept of what it means to be quote-unquote white in a moment, but what was behind each of those two strategies, the Spanish strategy of mixing, the Anglo-American strategy of separation?
Well, I think part of it was just kind of the realpolitik of the situation. The Spanish came over basically only as men, as soldiers and priests later, but without women, right? So that there was going to be
no choice,
a sexual, social mixture, inevitably. And the Anglos, British, and other some of the other European colonizers came as settler societies with families.
So then how did this play out in New Mexico? First of all, what was the nature of the Mexican resistance to the American colonization in the 19th century?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think that we often overlook the extent of the violence on the part of the Americans and the resistance on the part of the Mexicans at that period. We talk about the bloodless conquest of New Mexico, for example. That's sort of really enshrined both in popular mythology and in our history. But in fact, about 6 months after the Americans' military came in, there was very significant violent resistance in communities like Embudo and Mora and Taos and Arroyo Hondo and probably thousands of New Mexicans died during those contacts with the American military.
Thousands. That's a lot of people considering how sparsely populated it was.
That's really true. That's really true. And it was a lot of people because it was not only the probably hundreds of men who were engaged in the battles, but what the Americans often did in these villages that I just mentioned is they destroyed the food supplies, stored food supplies, and people would die later sort of in the mountains and that kind of situation. Another element that's really important here is that Taos Pueblo, the Americans in January of 1847 bombed Taos Pueblo with these huge cannons, basically, right up against the church. Bombed San Jeronimo Church at Taos Pueblo. And you know, there were murders and trials that resulted for murder and treason, and it was far from bloodless, I guess is my point.
We're talking to Laura Gomez. Her book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. Just for our listeners, what is the meaning of the word race? What is the meaning of the word ethnicity? Are these both human constructions?
Absolutely, and I want to make that clear, because oftentimes people hear the word race and they think that somebody is being racist by using the term race. And I want to make it clear that I join with the vast majority of scientists in the biological fields as well as social scientists who reject that there's any real difference according to race. In other words, if you take human beings of different racial categories, they are much more like each other than different from each other. So there's not a real biological difference. But there is this socially constructed difference. And what I mean by that is that in different time periods, in different places of the world, we understand race to mean different things. And in the United States, we have a particular, because of having the doctrine of discovery, which justified the taking of the lands from the Indians and slavery, and the fact that we had a constitution which didn't count Indians fully and didn't count slaves fully, we have that history. And I guess what I'm trying to do in this book is say, when we talk about race, we also should be talking about the Mexican experience in the Southwest, not just Indians and African Americans, and sort of broaden the discussion. But undoubtedly, these terms are unwieldy, and they should be. And we're also in a moment of experiencing some change about these things, right? Multicultural, multiracial people are Tiger Woods, right? The kind of, you know, Obama, right? Barack Obama. What race, you know, is he? And we're talking about that in a different way than we were talking about it. But my book is basically looking at the period from 1846, when the U.S. first invaded Mexico, in New Mexico, to 1912, when New Mexico becomes a state. So I'm looking, and I'm really trying to understand how did the people who lived at that period understand race? Trying not to impose our 21st century values on it. That's hard to do, and you know, maybe I don't always succeed, but that's what I'm trying to do.
So how did this play out legally? What were some of the legal ways in which race crept into the the system in New Mexico?
Well, before I get to New Mexico, let me just talk more broadly. One of the very first laws that Congress passed after the Bill of Rights was ratified was an immigration law, a naturalization law. And it said that only white people could become naturalized citizens. That was 1790. So this is very much ingrained in our history. Now, that's 1790, and yet in 1848, when the war with Mexico ends, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo stipulates that all of the Mexican citizens will become naturalized U.S. citizens. So that's
so they were by definition white, quote.
Well,
unquote.
that's the kind of interesting play there is, and you know from looking at the book that the Congress and the media, the national press, were talking about Mexicans as an inferior race, and yet here is Congress acting in this way to kind of classify them as white by allowing them to naturalize. And that naturalization law didn't change until 1870, after the Civil War, and then it was changed to say whites and African Americans, or those rather of African descent, could naturalize. Now, if we take that to the New Mexico context, there were really interesting debates about who was going to get that privilege of being legally white and be able to vote, be able to be running for elected office, and so on. And there was a strong argument made at that time by some Mexicans, and later by some Anglo-Americans, that Pueblo Indians were white and should have the right to vote. And Pueblo Indians were citizens under the Mexican Republic. So there was a real debate about that. Ultimately, that ends up getting decided against the Pueblos' favor, in the sense that they're designated not as white. They don't get the same rights that Mexicans get after the American takeover. And what I think that was about was a divide-and-conquer strategy. You know, we have the Pueblos and the Mexicans as the two major populations here. They're very similar in lots of ways. They live near each other. Let's make sure that we divide them by granting whiteness to these people and denying it to these people.
So there's a line of thinking in New Mexico that says that we here in New Mexico are different from other parts of the United States, and that, you know, that we're once Mexico, in that our, you know, Spanish-speaking, Spanish-heritage people are integrated into the power structure and always have been and are less oppressed than their counterparts, let's say, in Arizona, California, Texas. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's I call that the New Mexico exceptionalism thesis, and it's something I'm really interested in, and I really hope that this book will help spur some dialogue on that, because I think it's far from settled. But my take on it would be that a lot of the reason that today we think of New Mexico Hispanics as exceptional arises precisely from these violent and racist contacts in the early 19th century. For example, when we see the first development of a Spanish identity and let me step back a moment. In these documents that I looked at, the historical record, the Mexicans and the Americans are always using those terms, Mexican and American. It's not until the very late 19th century that the term Spanish begins to be used.
Isn't that interesting?
And I think it's really in response to the racism of against Mexicans, right?
Right.
And the term Mexican and the term greaser were used in the national press. And New Mexicans had a potential strategy for distinguishing themselves by saying, we're the heirs of the Spanish colonizers. We're different. And so that really puts it in a different kind of light.
But that's really a construction that is due to a kind of national race. I mean, one of the things you talk about in the book is the national response to New Mexico's bid for statehood compared to Colorado's.
Yeah, and why did New Mexico wait so long, right, even though it had more population? And it had everything to do with the fact that it was a majority Indian and majority Mexican population and a Spanish-speaking population, you know, until really even at the time that statehood occurs, heavily Spanish-speaking.
So, but back to this question of New Mexican exceptionalism, are we an exception to, are we different in certain ways than the other former Mexico states?
Well, so what I've been coming around to thinking, it's a great question, and I still spend a lot of time thinking about it. You know, you write a book, but you're still kind of kind of writing it in some senses because it's still on your mind,
yeah.
Is that New Mexico is different, but it's different in ways other than what this claim typically makes. We're not different because we are the legitimate heirs of the Spanish conquistadores. You know, that's not what makes us different. We're different because these particular demographics that we had, where there were so many more Mexican Americans than Euro-Americans, and such a substantial number of Pueblo Indians and other Indians. And it's those demographics that really make New Mexico unique and that produce some of the political disputes, but also the political negotiations and coalitions in history and today. And that is different. But it's sort of the legacy of that continues to make us different, but not in that way that I think that most people suggest.
We're talking to Laura Gomez. The book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race, and she will be at Collected Works today at 5:30, Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe. What were some of the differences between the Spanish, Mexican, and then the Anglo-American differences in terms of the law? You are a professor of law as well as American studies and a legal scholar, and I look at things like property rights and so on.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting subject, and which I do talk about in the book. One of the chief differences in terms of the two property regimes, the Spanish-Mexican property regime and the Anglo-American property regime, was that under the Spanish-Mexican system, there could be communally owned property, and there were these communal land grants, which some of which still exist in New Mexico today, but there were many, many more which never got confirmed by the government, because ultimately the U.S. government, although it took several decades after the war ended to clarify, the U.S. government at the Supreme Court level ultimately said, we're not going to recognize communally owned property. And, for example, in the case where they did that, the petitioners were seeking for the government to declare that they owned 315,000 acres of land communally in northeast New Mexico in the San Miguel County area today. And the Supreme Court certified that they owned 5,000 of those acres, and the rest of that land went into the public domain. The reasoning of the Supreme Court was it was owned by the Spanish government, and then it was owned by the Mexican government, and now we're the sovereign in the region, and so it's going to be owned by us. And that land went into Forest Service land, homesteading land.
When was that?
This decision was in right before the turn of the century, 1897, I believe.
So really, in terms of generational memory, it's not that long ago.
It's not at all. And you know, if you go back and you look at the list of national forests establishment in New Mexico, all of them were established basically between 1900 and 1920, almost all of them, all but a couple. And it was because of the turnover in this land, right? This policy allowed that land to be taken from communal ownership. And that in and of itself was interesting ecologically, right? So why did the Spanish-Mexicans have this communal ownership? It was a function of the arid region and the fact that if you were going to farm and do sheep herding, you had to have a lot of land to do that. You had to have a forest where you could get your water, you could get your firewood, you could hunt for your game. And so people needed... You didn't need a little bit of land, right? You needed a whole lot. And you needed to be in a community because a lot of that region was still controlled by the Plains Indians. They were the
right,
sovereigns,
right,
in a sense,
right, right.
You know, in that region. And so it was a very precarious existence.
We talk about cultural differences in, you know, in today's wonderful multicultural world. I would think one of the biggest cultural differences would be precisely that, communal ownership and single person or single family ownership of land, especially where survival is concerned. How did that play out in the different Anglo-American and Spanish-Mexican cultures?
Well, I think in the way that you suggest that there were very different notions. You know, for example, the notion that good fences make good neighbors, right?
Right.
That's an Anglo-American notion, right? You know, that
in fact, you
go back to New England, you see those old stone fences that are the remnants of those fences. That was the idea. You put a fence. This is your property. Whereas in the Spanish-Mexican system, you didn't really survey your land, and you certainly didn't mark it in that way. If it was surveyed, it was geographical, you know, that tree there or, you know, that stream there. And there weren't fences, right? It was a whole different idea. And, in fact, in the late 19th century, there was really resistance by some sort of Mexican-American renegades who would go and cut fences of ranchers in the Las Coras Blancas in the Northeast Plains region.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
You had an interesting piece in the end of your book where at a certain point your 10-year-old son says to you, "Mom, are we white?" How did you answer that question, and where did that question lead you?
Yeah. He asked this question over breakfast, and I basically followed up and said, well, what is it you're interested in? Because I didn't want to presume that the way that I was hearing the question was how he was hearing
it. Right, exactly.
And he said, well, when there was slavery, were we black or white? And, you know, it was this real, I think, honest kind of, okay, where did our people fit in that really important national moment of slavery? Not that all whites and all blacks were on the same side, you know. In fact, there were black slave owners, but that's a footnote here. But you know, I guess it led me to really think seriously about the extent to which we still, in our popular culture, in our everyday existence, we still tend to think about race as being about black and white. And you know, I think ultimately he was subconsciously asking sort of, where do I fit in this, you know? And he even said, after I explained some of this, he said, well, why don't we say black, white, and browns, you know? And
some people do.
Some people do. And that's changing. As I said, we're at a moment where there's some real, I think, flexibility occurring in this area. But in terms of that history that we tell about slavery, it's still very much black and white. And that makes it hard for a lot of us. And you know, I think it's a question of, well, where do Mexican Americans fit? We hear the term non-Hispanic white, which suggests that Hispanics are not white, right? So we sort of have it both ways right now in the U.S. without really talking.
And without any more having the legal codification of, you know, you can't vote if you're this race or that race. I mean, that's been done away with, but we still have all these complicated census forms, and you're always being asked to put what race you are when you fill out so much as a doctor's visit thing. I mean, I know, you know, 20-something white guys from Connecticut who put Pacific Islander just because they think the whole thing's so ridiculous.
That's scary to me. Because, you know, those things matter in terms of legal systems, in terms of the medical. You mentioned medical forms, right? There's a sort of a new effort in medicine to get more diversity in trials of clinical medications and things like that, because we don't exactly know. Most of those are probably not racial per se, but they're cultural, right? So, for example, we know that Mexican Americans and Indians have a much higher rate of diabetes. And, you know, we think that we have some ideas, doctors think they have some ideas about why that is, right? It's related to culture, it's related to race, and so you want to be able to figure those out, and you want to have the data, right? You need to have the data to sort of see those patterns and then intervene appropriately. You know, I'm not somebody who, there is a movement to sort of do away with all of those forms, and that's not my position. I think that we're far away as a nation from being able to say race is irrelevant. We're still dealing with that legacy, that historical legacy of how race continues to matter, as well as the current day inequality and discrimination that occurs.
Well, unfortunately, it is time to go, but this is a conversation that can be continued tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 5:30 in Santa Fe on West San Francisco Street, right across the street from the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. Laura Gomez will be there talking about her book and signing her book, Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. It's really been great to have you here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and Robert Knott will be with us in just a moment. Stay tuned. And I would like now to welcome Robert Knott. He is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo Friday Art Supplement in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. And he's singing Christmas carols already, and he is with us here speaking of the arts every Friday and trying to make me laugh and succeeding. Welcome, Robert.
Christmas. How you doing?
Good. How are
with
you?
With every Christmas, ta-da-rat, dump, dump. Bump it on. May your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white. Hey, lady,
hey,
I love
there.
The weather. It's not
I
too bad out
too.
There. Be a little careful on the roads.
You
watch
know, I've gotten a
guy.
Bunch of emails recently about how people love it when you burst into song.
Really?
Yep.
I think people like it when I burst into their bedrooms, too.
No, they don't.
Today is Friday the 14th. I'm glad it ain't the 13th. And there's several art openings tonight. I'd like to give a few of the visual arts openings. It might be a lovely night to walk Canyon Road, and if not Canyon Road, other areas of the town. For example, August Gallery Fine Photography in the Design Center, 418 Cerrillos Road, is doing photos by Doug Brown. It's called The Last Few Weeks of August in December. I like that title. The reception's 5 to 7. It's the final show of the gallery. It's been open a couple of years. I guess they're closing. Runs through January 10th. Tonight is the reception. There's several other openings in the Design Center, including Dorothy Rogers Fine Art. So just pop by for the holiday open house over there, 5 to 8 o'clock. They're not too far from downtown if you don't know where they are.
Excellent.
Backstreet Bistro, right across the street on Camino de los Marques. Friends Forever. What a great title for mixed
BFF.
Media.
BFF.
Huh?
Best Friends Forever.
BFF.
Yeah.
What's that then? That's a pseudonym for that?
That's, I think it's like a, you know, it's a text message young people era acronym.
Okay, that's good. One of these days I got to do some texting myself.
I'll text you.
Well, thank you. Now wait until after the show's over, otherwise you'll distract me. Friends Forever, mixed media work by Darlene Olivia McElroy and watercolors by Diane Moon. Reception's 5:30 to 7:30. Show runs through January 5th. Charlotte Jackson Fine Art, 200 West Marcy Street, Suite 101, how sweet it is. David Simpson, Light Wells Plus. Light Wells Plus, there's a plus sign. Paintings, reception 5 to 7 p.m. through January 11th. I called them the other day for some reason, and they were very nice to me, so I said I would mention them on the air. Charlotte Jackson, Fine Art. Gallery Zuger, downtown, 120 West San Francisco Street, has The Miniature Show, a group exhibit, reception 4 to 8 p.m. through December. I assume it's small paintings and not something to do with the singer midgets. Gerald Peters Gallery, 1011 Paseo de Peralta. Hello, all you in Gerald Peters land. Is doing a lifetime of imaging, the art of Margaret LeFranc. She lived from 1907 to 1998, and Paul Wiedemann wrote a story about her in today's Pasatiempo. Lovely paintings, a reception and book signing by Lois Katz, who wrote the book, is at 5 o'clock tonight through 7 o'clock tonight at Gerald Peters Gallery. The show runs through January 19th. We've got about three more galleries, and then we'll do shtick. Nussbaumer Fine Art, 314th South Guadalupe Street.
We'll do shtick.
Yeah. Open Hands, Open Hearts. It's a preview reception and exhibition of artwork for the December 15th, that's Saturday, art auction benefiting Open Hands, which, as you know, is a local nonprofit that assists disabled and the elderly in town. How can you not support something like this? 5 to 7 p.m., go over to 314th South Guadalupe to Nussbaumer Fine Art. Performance by guitarist Antonio Mendoza, no charge. And Owens Dewey Fine Art, also downtown. Downtown. Remember that song by Petula Clark? That's great.
Yeah,
I'm gonna
that's
think about
a
that
great
later.
Song.
I'll sing that later. It's got some mambo in it. Owens Dewey Fine Art is doing Paige Allen Declared Mystery, new work. Paintings, watercolors, monotypes, runs through January 26th. They're also doing a show called On Adobe Walls, American Paintings from the Santa Fe Collection. Also through the end of January. Reception 5 to 7 p.m. And we have a story on Paige Allen in today's Pasatiempo, which you can pick up for 4 bits.
Hey, did you see the snow globe exhibition? There's an exhibition of snow globes on Canyon Road, at 616 Canyon Road at the Cruz Gallery. And all different artists have created snow globes. You know what those are? You shake them up and the snow falls down.
That's what a snow globe is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, as the reception is today from 5 to 7.
I thought it was like a globe made of snow, and you put them together and you make a snowman.
No, Robert, that's not correct.
Untrained Boxcar Gallery is a train car on the tracks next to Site Santa Fe. I hear a train a-coming. They're going to show some art. This is it called House Toy Paper. Group show reception 5 to 8 p.m. So if you ever wanted to get into a train car and see art and hope that it doesn't suddenly take off and run away down the railroad tracks, which would be scary and also kind of comical, assuming nobody got hurt.
Assuming.
Yeah. It'd be terrible if that happened and there was like a loose lion on it at the same time. That happened in a Three Stooges movie once or so.
I'm sure it did. Hey, did we talk about the Santa Fe Art Institute? They have, not this weekend, but next week on Thursday at 5:30, they have got their Artists in Residence Open Studio, which they do about once a month, and they're going to have some of their residents showing their work. For more information, 424-5050.
I want to mention something you brought on the air last week.
Oh, yeah?
And I would have allowed you to do it again this week, but you were 1 week early, so it's my turn.
All right.
Eros Ophia, poems and dances of mystical and erotic love. Poetry and sacred dance with Jennifer Ferraro, Mira Krein, and guest vocalist Megan Chandler. 7 p.m. tonight at the Body of Santa Fe. What a place to do that. 333 Cordova Road. You got to pay to get in.
And I know that you'll be there, Robert Knott.
I'm going to show up an hour early when they're getting stuff ready backstage in case they need some help. 986-0362.
Hey, the annual holiday party for the Santa Fe Opera is a glamorous and festive black tie benefit. It's actually tomorrow. I suppose it's not too late. It's at the El Dorado. But if you want to find out more information, you can contact Joyce Idema at the Santa Fe Opera. Just give them a call up there.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
There's a lot of theater this week, and I'd like to go over three shows very quickly.
Oh, and here's the number up there. I was trying to find it, and here it is, 986-5902.
Okay, The Mousetrap. It's an isolated English manor. It's snowing. It's 1952. There ain't no cell phones. The phone in the house goes dead, and so do the victims. Yes, it's a murder mystery by Agatha Christie. Opening tonight, 8 o'clock, Santa Fe Playhouse. Champagne Gala Performance. I don't know why it's just a gala performance. There's some guys in it, too. Anyway, the show runs for, like, through the rest of the month. I wrote a very funny story, if I do say so myself, and I must say I
do.
In today's Pasta Tiempo, it's going to be fun. Go see it. And if I get killed or disappear before the show finishes its run, you'll know that there's something wrong. Then there's the excellent, in my view, Master Harold and the Boys.
Oh, I'm so glad you saw it. I love that play. That's one of the best plays I've seen
in
Santa Fe
ever.
It's
so well done.
Oh,
I am no offense, but I'm surprised because, A, it was thrown together very quickly, and, B, it was something of a vanity production because Quinn wanted – he was very honest about it. He wanted to do the show.
Yeah.
I'm always a little suspicious of those, but he, Tony Bufford, they're excellent. It's a really fine show.
Quinn Armstrong is a force of nature. He's one of the best young actors I've ever seen.
And
he's national caliber.
He's excellent, and I know he's going to have a good career. And he's matched by Tony and Tone. Even if you don't like theater, go see the show.
All three of them are great. Master Harold and the Boys at El Museo Cultural, and it's tonight and tomorrow at 8 o'clock and Sunday at 2 in the afternoon.
And I think, if I'm not wrong, we can't mention prices on KSFR, your community radio station. I think Sundays are pay what you wish. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize. Here's a phone number, 231-3682. And now I'll get myself in trouble.
I don't know about that because I'm looking at the card here, and it doesn't say whether it's pay what you wish or not. And
no, also, I'm wrong.
Great directing job by Clara.
I am wrong. It was last night was pay what you wish. You missed it.
So great, and also great directing job by Clara Soyster.
And then I know people will be disappointed with my theater work review, but I thought Hysteria was really a misfire.
Really?
I'm letting you know if you want to see the play. It's a very offbeat play. Theater work is back in action at the James A. Little Theater, 1060 Cerritos Road, tonight at 7:30, ditto Saturday and 2 p.m. Sunday. I wasn't too keen on the show. That doesn't mean you won't be too keen on it. My reviews of both these shows are in today's Pasta Tiempo and my preview of The Mousetrap.
So there's a couple of Rumi-related things. We had Zuleika
on. What
kind
of rumors? Rumi,
the 13th century
Rumi. There's
poet.
There's plenty of Rumi here for you and me.
Yes, there is. But there's an evening of devotional practice of zikr in honor of the life and poetry of Rumi, and that is tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Rail Yard. And it's a devotional group practice. Everybody is welcome. Harmony, chant, and organized movement with Zuleika Mirabai, Tara, Mahbood, Ahad, and others. Donations are gratefully accepted. And then on Tuesday at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center, the Rumi Concert, Lion of the Heart, and this is celebrating the 800th anniversary of Rumi's birth, an evening of poetry, music, dance, story, and humor featuring Zuleika, the dancer and musician and storyteller, and Coleman Barks, who we also had him on the air the other day, who is a poet and translator of Rumi, David Darling on cello, and Glenn Velez on percussion. And that's at 7:30 at the Lenzik on Tuesday of next week, December 18th.
Remember that old Ray Charles song that went, "They say Rumi, the poet, you really kind of know it." That song's great.
I don't know what you're talking
about. Hey, do you remember that song called Abba Dabba Honeymoon?
No.
That's really good. It just, I don't know, for some reason I woke up this morning and it was snowing out and I thought of Abba Dabba Honeymoon.
Well, it reminds me of the very worst rhyme of popular music.
Which is?
Abra, abracadabra, I want to reach out and grab you.
No, Abba Dabba Honeymoon is great. It's these two people are singing, and it's about a monkey and a chimp. I know just a couple words, and I swear I'll get back to the Christmas stuff. I go something like this. Abba Dabba 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 Dab said the monkey to the chimp.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that. Abba Dabba 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 Dab said the chimp to the monk. All day long just chirping away, all night long just making hay, singing and swinging in a monkey-tonky way. I got all the words wrong, but that's basically it. I love that song.
It sounds like something that would have been on the Flintstones. Native American Artisans Program presents the annual Children's Christmas Exhibit and Sale at the Palace of the Governors tomorrow and Sundays, the 15th and 16th of December. It's the Children of the Portal Artists Christmas Exhibit Sale. And this has been going on for a good 10 or 11 years. And it's from 10 to 4, Saturday on 10 to 4, and then Sunday from 1 to 4 in the community room. Let's see. And that says, in the community room of the Santa Fe Library, 145 Washington Avenue, a free event.
There's so many Christmas slash holiday slash goodwill events this weekend, and I will try to mention a lot of them. Christmas at the Palace tonight, 5:30 o'clock. That was really bad, but it...
5:30 o'clock.
I got it inappropriately rearranged. A visit with Santa and Mrs. Claus, gallery walks, refreshments, performances by local choirs, holiday keepsakes from Palace Press, arts and crafts. This is going to be a great thing. Take the kids. Go down on the plaza. There's going to be city sidewalks. Pretty sidewalks. Farolitos be lit. 5:30 to 8 o'clock, 105 West Palace. It's free. Meanwhile, Capitol High is joining up with the Santa Fe High School to do a concert band performance of holiday favorites. 7 o'clock tonight at Capitol High School. Tickets are very minimal, very cheap. 467-1107. Meanwhile, down at the Cathedral Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi?
Assisi.
That guy. A cathedral place, the Santa Fe Desert Chorale is performing its annual holiday concert called A Merry New Mexico Christmas. Have yourself a merry NM Christmas. What time is it at? It's 7:30. Where? I told you already. It's at St. Francis Cathedral. How much? You got to pay to get in. Phone number, 988-1234. We want more info. Pick up Pasta Tampa. Look at page 20. Craig Smith wrote about it.
Did you already talk about the house toy paper show at the boxcar?
Thank you for asking.
Because people brought a parchment scroll with information.
At the untrained boxcar.
Hey, how about for people living way up in Abiquiu, New Mexico, listening to 101.1 FM, which now has a much wider reach than our old signal, the Pueblo de Abiquiu Library and Cultural Presenter invites you to Posadas y Postres. And it's Sunday, the 16th, from 5 to 7 at the Abiquiu Parish Hall on the plaza. Homemade desserts and other surprises, new books, old friends, special guests, traditional violin and guitar music with Duo Chimayo.
I just remembered some more lyrics. Then the big baboon one night in June, he married them, and pretty soon they were singing and swinging on an Abadaba honeymoon. Ortega's on the plaza, San Francisco Street, on Saturday, is doing Women Helping Women, a group show and raffle of jewelry to benefit the Esperanza Shelter for Battered Women. There is a performance by Mariachi Buenaventura. Food, beverages. This is from 1 to 6 p.m. down on the plaza. No charge for entry, but you can pay for a raffle ticket and maybe win something. I got a phone number for you, 988-1866. Ortega's on the plaza is, by the way, at 101 West San Francisco Street. Meanwhile, Pop Gallery, also downtown, 133 West Water Street, has an exhibition and reception from 5 to 7 p.m. called Pop Toys and Tales. That could be really fun. And they're going to have a silent auction to benefit the NMNEA Read Across America program. So that's 5 to 7 p.m. on Saturday. They were at 133 Water Street. And finally, Ventana Fine Art, 400 Canyon Road, has an afternoon reception of Tom Noble Watercolors on Paper. The show runs through Christmas Eve. Then if you feel like going down to Lenzic, it's Saturday at 11 o'clock. They're doing Live from the Met at the Lenzic. But really, it's not live. It's what do you call it?
It is live.
What do you mean it's live? Isn't it shown on the big screen?
Yes, but it's a simultaneous broadcast.
Simultaneous with what?
With the actual live performance.
Which is where?
At the Met. The Metropolitan Opera in New York City.
Oh, so like somebody's got a video camera and they're streaming it in.
Yeah, the nature of that technology is far too nerdly for me to comprehend, but they do it.
I couldn't even figure out what you just said, let alone... Anyway, that's at 11 o'clock at the Lenzic, 988-1234. That night, if you want to get in the mood for Christmas, why don't you go see the show Getting in the Mood for Christmas? Greg Grissom and the Christmas Bells. Julie Trujillo, Ann Ruth, and Stephanie Duran. Man, what a trio of bells. I once had a pair of bells, and they were identical, except one had a mole about 3 inches above her.
There's a pair of dogs.
It ain't the same as a pair of dimes, which adds up to 20 cents. Piano accompanied by Chris Ishii, music of Irving Berlin and others. 8:30 p.m. on Saturday, Silver Starlight Lounge.
Hey,
500 Rodeo Road. Call 428-7781 for reservations. See the critical ear for information. Go.
And whereas everybody seems to be so happy and jolly and merry during the Christmas season, it's also a time where a lot of people get depressed. And if you have any kind of depression or know anybody who does, there's a 24-hour toll-free hotline to help New Mexicans with free resources during any kind of crisis. It's 1-866-HELP-1-NM or 1-866-435-7166.
Very good. Hey, what time is it?
It is 8:49.
Let me see. How about Scuola Cantorum of Santa Fe? This is El Niño, the Christ Child. It's a European carols, Gregorian chant. Northern New Mexico, Alabados. What's Alabado? I don't know. That's a Spanish word I do not know. 7 o'clock at the San Miguel Mission at 401 Old Santa Fe Trail on Saturday evening. It's free. There's also Amnesty International fundraiser on Saturday. Santa Fe High School students are going to present holiday music, farolitos, raffles, a light display, concessions. They're going to take the money from the concessions and the raffle to help reunite a Tanzanian. Is that right?
Tanzanian.
Thanks. I don't do that stuff on purpose. Believe me, I really do have trouble with words. A family that have been separated by war. This is from 4 to 7 p.m. at Oshara Plaza, Richards Avenue, north of Santa Fe Community College. There's no charge. They didn't give me a phone number. But it's at 4 to 7 p.m. at Oshara Plaza, Richards Avenue, north.
Hey, you talked about the Era Sophia poems and dances of mystical and erotic love at Body on Friday. But on Saturday at 6:30, Jonathan Hill, also at Body, plays free dinner music in the Soul Room. And also there's an evening of music and angelic healing with Max Heistein at 7 o'clock. And songs piano on piano and vocals and improvisational piece and so on.
Very nice.
Yes.
On Sunday, downtown. Las Posadas, you know what that is, right? The recreation of Mary and Joseph's journey through Bethlehem.
That's right.
With a candlelight procession followed by refreshments. Another wonderful, free, beautiful downtown holiday event, 5:30 to 7 p.m. Sunday, beginning at the Palace of the Governors. If you don't know where that is, it's on Palace Avenue. If you're visiting town, it's downtown on the plaza. You really can't miss it.
Hey, the Santa Fe Skating Club presents Winter in Neverland, a holiday skating show at the Genoveva Chavez Center. And that is on Rodeo Road Saturday at 2:30 and 5:30, and Sunday the 16th at 2 o'clock. For more information, 424-4986.
Did you ever see that Abbott and Costello movie where they get on ice skates and Costello gets at the end of a whip?
No.
That's a good one. The New Mexico Museum of Art Holiday Opening House.
Open house?
Yeah. 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday. Your buddy, the Gustav Bauman Marionettes, are going to be there. You can meet and greet the puppeteers and the puppets. Kids' activities, live music, refreshments, and photo opportunities with a Santa marionette. 1 to 4 o'clock, New Mexico Museum of Art, Sunday. Free, downtown, Palace Avenue. A lot of good holiday stuff downtown. Good stuff at the museums, which I think on Sundays, many of them are free for New Mexico residents.
Yay.
I don't know why I'm sniffling. Maybe I'm cold all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, it's snowing outside. It was.
Well, what's happening now?
The Salon Margraf second anniversary supper with Leslie Ayers and Geronimo Bonomo. And that's good food. It's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, RSVP. There is a price for the delicious food and cooking, and the number is 955-0471. And I've been there, and the food is good.
On Wednesday, Santa Fe Pro Musica is doing a Baroque Christmas concert. It's called... Here we go again with these. They put these names in italics already. I get nervous. Natale Allegro. It's a chamber music performance celebrating Christmas.
Oh, Natale is the Italian word for Christmas.
Oh, that's it?
Uh-huh.
Natale. Say it again.
Natale.
Okay, that's nice.
And it's the same root as natal, which means the birth of Christ, which is what Christmas is celebrating. So that's where it all comes.
Excellent. Well, they're doing this chamber music deal celebrating Christmas in Italy. Music of Vivaldi, Corelli, and Chico Marx. 8 p.m. Loretto Chapel, 211 Old Santa Fe Trail, 988-1234. Another holiday event listed in Craig Smith's Critical Ear column. He lists like six concerts. So even if you know you're not a fan of pasta, pick it up. Look at his column. He will tell you a lot about what's happening here.
Did you say Chico Marx?
Yeah, one of the Italian Marx brother. I don't understand those guys. One talked too much. One didn't talk at all, and one spoke in Italian. Didn't that ever baffle you?
No.
At least with the Three Stooges, they just spoke like with their fingers going into each other's eyes. You're kind of very simple.
So the film Miss Navajo continues at the Santa Fe Film Center, and Lost and Found in Mexico. That's another documentary about Americans living in San Miguel de Allende. I haven't seen that one, but people did like it. And a film called Endgame opens today, and that's an Alex Jones movie that chronicles the history of the global elite's bloody rise to power and reveals how they have funded dictators and financed the bloodiest wars, creating order out of chaos
what's going on here?
to pave the way for the first true world empire.
The holidays are coming up. You used the adjective bloody about 8 times in that description of the movie.
Just once, but, you know, no, twice.
No,
right?
You like this, a bloody head, and then the bloody heads, and then bloodiness, and then that bloody...
But it's a movie that many people in Santa Fe might want to see, so I'm just telling you.
All right, well, I mean, we should think of goodness and joy and all that.
And the CCA also has terrific movies, as does the screen at the College of Santa Fe.
Well, since we're talking about morbid things, today Will Smith opens up that mega picture, I Am Legend, as the last man on Earth. And it turns out that, like, there's zombies after him and stuff. So that's the thing I got to go review.
Oh, by the way, Taryn Lovewave, who's the host and producer of Camp Lovewave on KSFR on Saturday mornings, is going to be introducing that film Endgame. And then tomorrow...
He's going to introduce I Am Legend?
No, Endgame. I'm sorry, I was on... And Camp Lovewave airs tomorrow morning, Saturday at 10 a.m.
See,
go
ladies,
ahead.
Sometimes you don't listen to men, and I don't blame you. Stories from the Hearth is nice. Students from the New Mexico School for the Deaf are going to present their annual winter variety show at 7 p.m. Thursday, James A. Little Theater at the New Mexico School for the Deaf. It's very inexpensive to get in. We can't mention prices. It's a community radio station. But, I mean, you could get in for, like, you know, a dollar. All proceeds benefit the Empty Stocking Fund, which is a very good fund to benefit because it's a stocking that's empty. Here's a phone number, 476-6399.
Hey, did you mention the Monica Caden Studio Christmas Show at 514 Alto behind
the... I'm delighted you're going to do it.
Santuario.
Take it away.
...Santuario de Guadalupe. Friday, today, and tomorrow from 10 to 5 and all the way through December. For more information, 989-4944. That's ours.
The Winter Solstice Celebration, Thursday night. We Are the Ones We've Been Waiting For Productions teams up with Gateway Performance Productions. It used to be a Santa Fe company, now based in Atlanta, Georgia, to present an evening of dance, poetry, music, theater, ceremony, art, 7:30 p.m. at the newly formed 1228 Parkway Art Space, which is at 1228 Parkway, Suite F, as in fun. This is off Rufina Street. They're requesting a donation, and all proceeds benefit the Santa Fe Vet Center, which is for veterans, not for animals. 316-2010 starts Thursday night, runs through next weekend. Say what time it is.
It is 8:57.
How can it be that?
And it's getting to be time to go, ladies and gentlemen.
The last weekend of Madrid Christmas, if you want to drive to Madrid, is next weekend. You can go this weekend and next.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org and leave a message at 428-1528. And you can also leave a message telling us what you think about Robert Knott, which people do. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz a la carta. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company.
You be peaceful and well. Am I going to see you next Friday for our annual Christmas show?
We are. We're going to have our annual Christmas show. We're also going to have a New Year's show together on New Year's Eve.
Which is a Monday.
So rather than that Friday, we're going to devote the entire Monday to...
But then I'll come back the following Friday, January 4th.
Yes, you will. So we'll see each other twice in one week.
Oh, boy, I'm going to make up for all those weeks you kept me off the air.
Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Anyway, with that
My name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. I mean, see you on Monday.
Pretty soon, ever singing and swinging on an abba-dabba honeymoon.
Bye.
Ciao.